Stage number 801, Sydney Quinn, final reel 3.
So the word came down, we're getting some reinforcements up. They made contact with us at last. This isn't the third week of the war, third week of the battle. And I always remembered a fellow called Dick, who was a Canadian. Now, the base wallers get an awful bad name in any war. See? But most men with average intelligence know somebody's got to do that bloody job. But Dick couldn't stand the wee insinuations that was more or less slung at him. He volunteered to go up to the front. He knew we were having a rough time. And he came up. And without a word, he heard these boys crying. But we decided by this time that they're all dead. This was a ruse by the fascists, you see, maybe the Moors, imitating boys crying. Dick couldn't stand it longer. He just rushed over the top and down. He's dead, isn't it? They just chewed him up. That man was hounded to his death. That's what I was my feeling. You know, the base was not, so it wasn't right. He should have been restrained, but we couldn't restrain him because we had casualties lying dead beside us. Bob Elliott was lying dead. He was a councillor from Newcastle. A lot of good fellows there. A lot of Irish guardsmen lost their lives up there. And bloody well left the Irish guards to come to the Armour Front. It's not very well known that, but I'd spoken to most of them. Quite a few of them. And I thought it was a tragic loss of life for nothing. But we got the word that there's no relief. It's a poor old Copeman, he's off his nut. He's got about 50 men left. And if he makes a blunder, he's going to lose a lot of them, including himself. So I think he takes this, I'm not sure, but I don't think he's really got the order to come back. But I think he weighed up the situation and he decided to bring us back. Well, see, bringing us back, well, just lost us half as many men again. Because the fascists just jumped into our positions and they pursued us. But there was never a rout. We just fired back. Oh, I remember getting one. This guy was dressed up in the blue jacket and red trousers, pantaloons, and a fez. He must have been a bloody Turk or something. But he was coming round the centre, and I looked and saw him through the thicket. I know what he's doing. He's making a move towards us, and there's a man just behind him examining a horse's hooves. That's some of the crazy things in that, in a house just over the side. This man more concerned about his horse than a war just really send him in the kingdom come. He's examining his horse's hoof. It's another fellow there talking about the two fishermen. You hear them in the day. Yeah. That's just sort of crazy things happen. Well, I put one through this with a fellow's stomach anyway. But our big regret, most fellows that was there must remember it. We had to leave her wounded. We couldn't save them, the majority of men, you see. Well, we must have had 7 or 8 men wounded. Men with their stomachs lying out, you know, trying to hold them in. Couldn't move, but we couldn't carry them because we're absolutely spent. And the fascists put down anti-personnel stuff. This shrapnel, it just come out like that. And so, took a few casualties there too. We got out of range of that, and they licked our wounds, as you may say. And the word came up that to go with big Bob Walker, Nathan had been killed. Unlucky, he'd got a splinter out of a bone and took the side right out of him. But I always remember burying him. There was an old makeshift coffin. And you see the entrails all lying over the place. What an end to a very brave man. Most fellas, because they've all different stories to tell you, but that's what's impressed me in that war. And that's where I'd like to finish. Because I think on that note, that's where the war was lost in Spain. I'm convinced of that. I'm no military tactician.
Brunetti.
I think the war was lost there. The preparation they put into it. But this stupid insistence of taking this village, pinning men down, maybe 2,000 or 3,000 men round about it. Left 1,000 men, yes, and got round about it. And bloody sure we would have made a big difference. I don't say we'd have won the war on that assumption alone, but it was touch and go. We didn't have the strength to go any Brunetti in force, you see. Franco realised that. he come back in the force. He'd nothing to worry about Villain and Evander. He could batter hell out of it because it was us in it. But I've read a few books about the things, and they've all different angles to it. But I always remember the individual courage of men who were at it, especially that first aid man Jones, because he'd done Herculean work, there's no doubt about it. He was killed later, Saturday. So this is Sidney Quinn signing off. Thank you very much.
What happened to you after Brunetti then?
Well, we were taken out, and we lay about 6 months. I put it on. Is it on?
Yes.
Put it on. Mm-hmm. And the word came up, Jock Cunningham came to me. There's two or three things in this campaign I don't want to dwell upon, because it's something in my word against everybody else, and these fellows are dead. Understand? But there's one comrade came to me. This is refreshing my memory. Things are pretty grim. Ebenetti. He says, Sid, he says, you know the road back to Madrid? I say, every good soldier knows the escape road. See? He says, well, you want to take it. This thing's hopeless. Now, that was a high up fella. Now, he got that off his chest. He's trying to save me, you see? He steps forward, he says, right. He says, every Communist Party member will volunteer to stand here and die if necessary. One step forward. So maybe the Communist Party had to put one step forward. So I was back in the shit again. But he must have said to himself, well, but I realised myself, if I went for that, I was going to get killed, because there's two bloody big engagements, you know, Harama and thing, and there were only, I think, seven of us left from the original party that went to L'Opera. So we're lying, and we've got a lot of new fellas. I forget where we went to rebuild or reform. Copeland was taken out. Well, everybody knows Copeland was taken away. You know, a bit of an argument with some of the fellow commanders. Hope that didn't go too well. And Fred was taken away. I think he was given leave. And Joe Hinks took over for a while. Now, Joe Hinks was a man who had sided with the Chinese in 1929 at the Sha Pai Bridge. Do you know anything about that?
Mm-hmm.
He joined the Chinese troops for a time before he came back to his own unit. That's the type of man he was. Now, Joe was an unassuming character. He didn't like responsibility, because he was a softy, you know. He didn't like put men in these certain positions where they're going to get killed anyway. But Fred was a different man. He had the right idea. Well, if they're going to get killed, they're going to get killed, but they're ready to do a job. Well, Joe took over, and then, we were taken out and put in this more or less reserve position to build up our strength again. Well, it must have been about 3 or 4 weeks later. A certain company comes to me and says, he says, there's 5 years going on the propaganda leave, you know. Well, I was never a propagandist. But apparently, we would never have got away if we just say, you're going home. They do something to satisfy the authorities. Now, I wasn't running away. No, the rest of them. But we thought we'd done our share. Understand me? So, we got put to another camp, Camp Lucas. Now, this camp was peopled by fellas who had lost their nerve, you see. I always remember a French delegation come out to interview some of the French comrades that had run away. And the French had been excitable. Yes, well, they were convinced. The trade union people talked them into doing their duty, you know, brotherly duty, you see. So right away they got camions up, back to the front. But they made sure they got the wine things well filled before they went up. So, oh, he might have raised this. But one broke down, you see. I think it was Tom Clark, he was at Madrid too. Tom Clark says, these bastards will be back again, watch us. So, well, we waited, and sure enough, 2 or 3 hours later, they come back. One by one, I could drink them. No, I never blamed a man for getting off, because it's natural for a man not to walk into death. It's natural as anything. But it's not bloody good political tactics. So I don't know what happened to them, but they must have been repatriated eventually, because they're no use to anyone.
Tell me, you know, the story about when they said members of the Communist Party stepped
I wish you, there was only about half a dozen of us full-time members of the Communist Party, you see.
And who asked this question?
That's why I'm not telling you.
But anyway, the question was asked.
Oh, the question was asked, didn't it?
And what did it mean? That those who stepped forward would stay there?
They would stay there, yes.
And the rest would go into reserve?
But the rest didn't go into reserve, they all stepped forward. As soon as we stepped forward, they come on, obviously, see. So no, there's no heroics about it.
Yeah.
No, so. Anyway, that was the end of my military career until they caught me again. But I like most of the comrades here, they all went through maybe just as harrowing experiences in the Second World War as we did. But the world stopped for us in 1939. It was more
tell me about the camp that you were talking
about.
Was it Lukács?
Camp Lukács, yeah.
Camp
Lukács. CZ or something, ZC or something.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it was peopled by all sorts. There must have been 2,000 men there. More or less a transit camp, see?
For those returning home.
And those returning home and those returned to the front, right. And as I say, a lot of fellas had lost their nerve. They were there, but there's no depression or anything like that. Just let them lie there for a while until they more or less talking about it. Right? But I remember one young fella. I think it's safe to mention his name now. I remember his name clearly. John Duncan. He'd come straight from March Lenin Institute in Moscow. But he found his human nature couldn't face it. Now, that poor fellow sitting in a tent himself, isolated. He probably sent home more or less disgrace, but the war was such that it took everybody, you see. But the communists were right in what they said. You've got to put your life where your mouth was. And I'd have never lived it down the rest of my life if I hadn't made that effort. But at the time, I thought I'd done enough. And I wasn't seeking death. So when we come up with this thing, there's only 5 or 6 years left. We'll put you home in a propaganda thing. I believe it was Malcolm Dunbar was the man responsible for it. So, don't say thanks.
Do you think they were giving you the opportunity there?
Oh, we could have volunteered to come back again, but no, I don't think I'd ever come back. Because I say the war for me finished there, Brunetti. Okay.
How do you look back on it now? This...
Well, as I say, we'll say, I was there, that was all. It was well worthwhile. I regret the loss of young, fine young lives, you know, intellectuals, you may say, but with some other fine comrades there. There's one comrade from Manchester, Hugh Barker. Now, he was right to the end, but he'd been wounded. He must have been the longest serving man in Spain. Never a cheap out of him, never a word. He couldn't even have faced that. He'd have said no. But he was that character. Morris tells me he died about 7 years ago, cancer. He was in the submarine service during the war. Well, salt of the earth character, you know.
When you came back, did you continue with your political activity?
I moved to London to find work. Work was still hard to find then. And I got a job in a hotel. But I died a 1,000 deaths for these fellas out there. I'll tell you that. And followed, but it was hopeless. Yeah. Got married. It's called up. Went through this usual grind. But stayed alive there too. It was the same thing. See, the Second World War. With the same problems too. Well, the fell on the floor. He sees all the mistakes. He doesn't. The only thing he pays for on this is his life. You understand that? The other fellows say pay for their reputations. But he pays for his life. But he still gives him the right to criticise him. And we saw some bummers of decisions. I remember I joined the Royal Artillery. This fellow had just been made up to major. So he took us out. This is before the real war started. This was in 1943, I think it was. 42, 43. He took us out in a scheme was it Chester and Wales? I'm forgetting now. Map reading expedition. The whole battery of guns behind him. And he decided this, it was outside Belfast. He decided, we'll take this route back to camp. Now the fellow was reading the map, said, "Sir, it's a restricted road." "Doesn't matter, just go down." And they're grading about 1 and 6, I think it was, see? And he's these bloody big guns. So he's down halfway. He just says, "Stop, for God's sake, everybody stop." Everybody jump out, dismantle everything, into a field, knock down all the hedges, and get back up again. 2 or 6 hours to disentangle us. He was a captain in a week's time. Well, that sort of thing happened. Yeah. Even during the action we saw. I didn't see much action during the Second World War. We helped in the taking of Antwerp, not us, but the division. Horrocks. We took Antwerp, Bremen, and always remember a Yankee character. We're going through Bremen, and this Yanks, everything was going at a snail's pace. We went into Germany over rooftops in Osnabrück, you understand that?
Yeah.
It was flattened. So the only way we could get over the rooftops, the division, you see. And we'd come into Bremen anyway. I always remember a big fat Yankee, and a big cigar, and the gold teeth. He says, "That was some experience there, bud." He says, "It took us 6 years to knock off Hitler. It only took me 6 years to knock off that Frohlein there." 6 minutes to knock off Frohlein, he says. It's good to laugh.
Looking back on the battalion, the British battalion, mm. and comparing it to what you saw in the Second World War, I mean, how efficient was the British battalion?
Oh, very efficient. For the resources they had.
An effective fighting force?
Without a doubt. I mean, it's all right saying we were ragtagging. We had a very low opinion of ourselves. But in hindsight, looking back, we weren't too bad. And from what we got from some of the deserters, even that day, Peter Fleming, was it Peter? Peter Kemp.
Kemp, yeah.
He'd admit that we weren't so bad after all. And he was fighting the cream of the Moors, you understand me? Well officered. Yes. So they weren't too bad.
What was your impression of the Moorish troops that you faced?
Ah, well, of course, they're Allah characters. You'd kill them with this Allah, or Muhammad Ali, the bloody hell. No Muhammad Ali. Oh, they came at you. No doubt about it. Oh, they came at you. Oh, you had to kill them. No doubt about it. They weren't surrendering. Oh, no, they didn't surrender. If it had been ordinary Spanish troops, would have wiped them up. With their own Spanish troops, untrained troops, would have wiped the Spanish regular army up. Because we gave them that backbone, you see. So we saw some things happening in the front, said, never in any history books, never did. Whole regiments, down our road, young Spanish troops, they had no idea. Officered by young Spanish fellas.
Fascist troops?
No, fascist.
Or Republican.
Republicans. Yeah. But once they got the backbone from us, they stayed and they're trained. That's a known. That's a strikingly true. That's a fact.
Did you ever join a Spanish contingent in Spain at all?
No, we were just the 12th division.
You just with the British battalion the whole time.
I was hopeless at languages. But with one character, when I was in charge of the regimental guard, Cheeky McCaig, he came from Glasgow, and he was a member of the Cheeky 40 gang. You probably read it up somewhere.
Yeah.
And he got the name Cheeky. But he was bullheaded, and he didn't argue, he just hit you with his head, you see. That was the end of that. But Cheeky came out of Spain, I always remember him in Madrigueras. Everybody was starving. But Cheeky was down the road, eating well, speaking fluent Spanish in a fortnight. Eh? Yeah, laughing and joking, singing in Spanish. And I couldn't even know what was right. I wouldn't even know what's just the road in Spanish.
But Cheeky, what happened to him?
I don't know. I think he ran away. Never went. Well, some of our fellows ran away too, let's face it.
Was desertion a big problem?
No, not a big problem. No, we'd a few, but they come back. Understand? Their conscience couldn't take them to the frontier. We found they were turning up themselves. A few went over, Few went back, but most of them come back and did very well in the battalion. I can name names, but what's the use of them? Why do you do it?
What about deserters from the other side, fascists?
Well, I'd say, to my knowledge, I'd seen four on the Harama front. And that was a... We were always like... As I say, I wrote a letter to my... I'm an over Brunetti, and a letter to Morris. And we were always seen to go up the hill, but... In many ways, it was to our advantage. Because if we put a volley over from Harama, it had no way to go but into somebody or into something. But when they were firing at us and over our trenches, into the blue, see? Although they took a few of us, they killed a few fellas, especially when they're going for rations. That was pretty bloody hairy, I can tell you that. You see, the camion couldn't come up any further, but we had to walk about a mile in to get it. And he just wanted to take his turn at it. But they had their machine guns sighted in that, you know, fixed sighting, and they just press a trigger and they saw a movement. Many a time we come back with new rations. It just blew out our horns. But the fellas that have been there, they'll never regret having gone. Even the fellas that were badly wounded, never regret it. You can ask them that. I'm sure you did. Mm,
yeah.
They never regret it.
Do you think that there is a sort of message from Spain now that it's relevant?
I think I should know that. It's got to come. Well, I know there's a lot of manoeuvring going on to get them into this common market. And the only way they can get into the common market is they provide a modicum of democracy. And that's the way they're going. But they're not going to give too much. And the Spanish communists, they don't want to create another bloodbath whilst they're relatively weak. Oh no, we'll get democracy there and they'll go back. I hope to. Even just to walk down that Puerto del Sol. And I regret all the fellas that got killed in it. Fine fellas. But I knew if I had to stay on, I was going to be dead myself. Couldn't escape it, you know. Fellas killed it, and I'm still walking about. Sometimes they greet me, "Are you still alive?" You know, that sort of thing. You get a wee bit wary, could you? No. So there's seven of us. Jack Kilpatrick, Tom Clark, Frank Knight, the violinist, George Rowe. I think there were two others. Names escape me at the moment. We were given the freedom to go home. But there were none of us heroes, so we took it. I don't regret it. I don't think there's any blame attached to me. Because there was no condition played on. No conditions.
Was your experience in Spain ever held against you afterwards in the Second World War?
All the way.
Really?
Oh, aye. Well, you get to know things. I was a duty driver, driving the Russians. And I'd done a lot of work in and out of the office. One day, one of the battery clerks, Joe Hughes, I remember him, he says, "I just seen your dossier," he said. He says, "You'll never get a promotion." This man not to be promoted. Well, they're dead scared, isn't it? We're only a handful, you know. Mm-hmm. Well, you've heard Bill Alexander and all them telling the same thing. The same happened to all the lesser fry. These are well known, and I was unknown. But they knew enough about me to keep me responsible so he doesn't see any secret documents like that, you see. That was the purpose of it.
What about in terms of getting a job in civilian?
Ah, no, I didn't mind. Didn't bother me.
No trouble?
No. I was always in the lower bracket, you know, hotel work and whatnot. I didn't have any skills or high intellectual attainments, you know, that most people had. See, most of these fellows are speaking today, and remember, they're all sort of college lecturers, university examiners. No, they've had a good life, let's face it. I've had to scratch and scrape all my life, because I couldn't reach the mental pitch these fellows had. I don't say it's my own fault, but I just couldn't do it. I have a son just now. He graduated as a minister. He's lucky to get a church. And he's going to work for about 30 quid a week with a wife and Wayne. Now, what's the use of education if that's all they can offer them? Another son graduated the same week as Bachelor of Science. No chance of a job. So.
Well, thank you very much, sir.
Okay.
Yes, indeed. That was very kind of you. I'm sorry to keep you so long.
That's me who kept you long. What's the sound? Yeah. Good to me, you've got me a drink.